Good morning. I'm Christopher Purdy. I'm delighted to welcome you all to All Sides Weekend. This is the book show. A lot of people are excited about the book show, no less than our three panelists and myself. It's already been pretty bawdy off mic for the last 5 minutes, so we are warmed up here to talk about books, beginning with Cassie Rose, who is WOSU's book critic. Her blog is thelongestchapter.com. It's very important and very entertaining for anybody who loves books and loves to read. Chris Hickey is here from the Whetstone branch of the Columbus Library, where she serves as youth services manager. And Chris Hickey comes every month and brings us the latest quick picks from the library, those books everybody wants to read. Chris Hickey is going to tell you how to skip the line. And Nick White is here. Nick White is on the faculty of the Department of Creative Writing at The Ohio State University. He is a published author, and his ideas of what to read are always right on the money. So I want to start with Nick White. And what did you bring us to read today?
You know, I'm going to be talking about this unknown book called The Great Gatsby by this upstart F. Scott Fitzgerald. You may or may not know, this year marks the 100th anniversary of the publication of this book, which, when it was published at the time, was kind of a flop. And it was only after World War II that the book really started to take on kind of the acclaim that it has now. And so in its 100-year anniversary, I decided to reread it again, because I think the last time I read it was not in high school, but in college. And I've just been bemused by it and bewitched by it. The language just completely caught me up again. I mean, the sentences here are so beautifully and are just written beautifully and sparkle like champagne. And there are so many wonderful set pieces in this book. And I want to recommend this book to anyone who has not read what we call quote unquote classics recently, and maybe are a little intimidated by works that we consider classics. This book is under 250 pages. It's a very slim book, and it's very approachable, and it offers all the things that good literature can offer when you're reading it. It shows you beautiful language, interesting characters, a bit of melodrama, intrigue, it's gossipy, and it's written in a kind of style and a kind of prose that is both approachable and just really, really beautiful. I've been reading it alongside a book by Maureen Corrigan entitled So We Read On, How the Great Gatsby Came to Be and Why It Endures. And in this book, she explores not only the language of Gatsby and the history of the biography of F. Scott Fitzgerald and his wife Zelda and the times that they grew up, but it also talked about the life of the Great Gatsby and how it became a kind of mainstay in high school literature teaching that book, and how that was both a blessing and a curse, because I think we learn about it in high school and maybe we don't ever go back to it.
Well, that's interesting you say that, because I'm somebody else who read it in high school and well, it was assigned in high school. Now, whether I read it or not is neither here nor there. And I read it again in college and didn't do anything for me. I read it again about 15 years ago and was enthralled. And I don't know if you have to be of a certain age. I don't know if you have to have some life experience behind you before the book resonates. I don't know. Do you have a thought about that?
You know, I don't know either. I think that I do know that I have this phenomenon, and I don't know if anybody else does, but as soon as someone assigns me to read a book, I automatically cross my arms and hold it against the book.
And I do the same thing. And,
yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And I feel that way almost sometimes when I teach books for classes too.
You are. That's
and,
what you
yeah,
do.
Yeah, because I'm like, why did I assign this book to myself? And so that might have something to do with it, this idea of requiring to read it. I think that sometimes gives The Great Gatsby a bad rap. But I think just like coming to it, you know, in spring and thinking about it being 100 years old and getting back into it, I didn't appreciate at the time how lively the book is. The book is alive. The characters are alive.
And like, stuff happens.
And stuff happens.
Well, and is it the characters or is it what happens? That, like, Christopher, for you, that enthralled you, the you know, the third time.
The language.
Okay.
I will tell you. I mean, I knew the bear. There is a plot, which there are some novels don't really have. There is a plot to this one. There are characters who are very interested, who resonate. But I remember, and I was in my 40s reading it, trying it for the third time and snapping into it, that the language really grabbed me. And I can't really tell you why, except that I when I finished it, I knew I had finished something really wonderful. Mm-hmm. I mean, I knew I had sort of given myself a gift in reading that book again.
Well, and I would say what gripped me this time, and I've been I'm a reader and a writer that pays attention to this and sort of gravitates to this, but place, like I think the city of New York, Long Island, East Egg and West Egg really came alive, and how Fitzgerald captures that. And we get little vignettes of characters. And he's so, I mean, when we say it's a lyrical book, I don't want someone to think that, oh, he spends, 30 pages talking about the wallpaper. But he is so concise in this book. He has such a great ability to summarize a character in just one or two sentences. And you immediately sort of get them immediately. When they come on the stage and they perform, and I think the other thing too is it's a story that is an act of remembering, right? So that positions the narrator of Nick Carraway as both telling us the story and then interpreting the story for us as we're going along, and it creates a kind of interesting relationship between you, the narrator, and the story.
One of the things that really struck me, I remember now, in the language were the cars. Speed, the distance, and the light on Long Island, and just the imagery that way. I mean, as you say, I mean, I think I was living in New York at the time I read it and got it. And I think that might have helped me a little bit because, I mean, places where Manhattan doesn't change much in terms of its geography and where the streets are. So, I mean, you could go there and stand, and it probably looked, at least the traffic was probably the same as it was 100 years ago in terms of.
You know, my two corgis are named Fitzgerald and Daisy. And when I walk the dogs, and people will ask me the names of the dogs, some people get it that it's, and in fact, I was walking by and they were sitting outside at a restaurant. And I said the names and he yelled out, he said, "The Great Gatsby" is what he did. He yelled out. And I said, "Yep, you got it."
Or they think, "Isn't she odd, that lady?"
Probably.
Well, thank you, Nick. I was taken aback when I realized that it's 100 years, that
right.
book. Yeah.
Right.
And it does endure. People still read it and talk about it for a reason, So.
And stuff happens. There's plot, there's action, there's intrigue, there's romance. It's built like a fine watch. It's sort of finely tuned.
I remember this one line, one tiny line. Daisy comes over in the afternoons, but it means a lot of different things given the context of the book. So if you pay attention and dig a little bit, you'll be rewarded.
And there's that green light too.
The
green light. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm thinking about when Daisy recounts giving birth to her daughter, and she says, she finds out it's a girl, and she starts to cry, and she says, I hope she's a fool. That's right. The only way a girl needs to be in this world is a fool.
Probably couldn't say that today, but it's a 100-year-old book.
Well, those were lines that supposedly Zelda said when she had her daughter.
Anyway, The Great Gatsby opens our book show. Where do we go from here? I'm Christopher Purdy with Cassie Rose, Chris Hickey, and Nick White. Chris Hickey, give us a quick pick from the library, which The Great Gatsby should be, by the way. But go.
The Great Gatsby, I had a similar experience to you, Christopher, where, I had to read it, so I didn't like it. But then reading it as an adult, it was extraordinary. And that feeling of desire as, Jay Gatsby is looking across and he's seeing the light and he knows that that's where Daisy is. I just found that, such a great moment.
That's an erotic book with very little erotic language in it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
With just beautiful, beautiful language. That's an art that Fitzgerald had. Anyway, I digress.
Should we go to the Land of the Fae?
Yes.
Okay, let's go to the Land of the Fae. So our Columbus Book Festival is going to be July 12th and 13th. This is our third one. Very excited. And this week we announced our headliners. And one of those headliners is Amal L. Motar. And she co-wrote This Is How You Lose the Time War. So that was sci-fi.
Very popular book.
Very popular. That was sci-fi. This is fantasy. And I finished this. I listened to it on audio and I finished it as I was pulling into the parking garage this morning. And it is extraordinary. So it's a novella. So it's short. And it also has a short story on the end. So you get a couple stories in this book. It's called The River Has Roots. And it is about two sisters. They are the Hawthorne sisters. Esther and Isabel, and their lands border some kind of portal into the world of the Fae. And their family is charged with tending to the willow trees that are known as the professors. And they are somehow an entrance. It's very hard to get into this world. It's very dangerous to get into this world. So they sing to the willows. And in exchange, the willows give them magic to this land. And they refer to magic as grammar. And she's very intentional about this. So grammar as in riddles and translations of magic. And this is it's the language in which she writes this book is just so beautiful. And the audiobook was recommended to me. So I experienced it that way. And there's sounds of river in the background. There's ethereal singing in the background. And it is beautiful. So Esther is the oldest sister, and she falls in love with one of the Fae. And this Fae's name is Rin. And she refers to them as they because Rin, the Fae have different forms. So Rin appears in different ways, sometimes female presenting, sometimes male presenting, sometimes as a storm or an owl. And they fall in love. And it is a beautiful love. But Esther also has another suitor who's a violent man who wants her land. And so there's a conflict there that I won't say anything more about. But if you want a lyrical, beautiful... Do you remember Enya? The ethereal?
Enya.
Yes.
Jog
this is
Enya
in book form.
Oh, my God.
Yes. Yeah, so
Sign
it's got that
up.
Vibe and that beautiful... And there and another reviewer... said it was like stepping barefoot into an enchanted forest. Oh. And the epigraph at the beginning of the story is, what's a river but an open throat? What's water but a voice? It is absolutely beautiful.
Sounds like it could be an Orinoco Flow by Enya.
That's what I felt like I was hearing kind of in the back of my mind as I'm listening to this story. And if you love it, you can meet her when she's at the book festival this
summer. Before we take our first break, remind us about the book. Let's start talking about the book festival in July.
Yes. So the book festival, this is our third year, and it's free to the public. It's at Main Library. There's all kinds of, there's panels. We have our headliners. So you can go from room to room and hear about different books. There's all kinds of swag you can buy. And it's just a great
time.
It's
a lot of fun.
It's so much fun.
It's in the back lawn of the library and in the main building.
Yes,
so
it's all over.
Everywhere.
Are the headliners online? Or
the headliners are online. Mm-hmm. We have social media, the Columbus Book Festival, that will have all kinds of information. We also have it on our website. But we're looking forward to it. It's always a great time.
We'll talk more about it on subsequent shows until the date. This is All Sides Weekend Books. We're going to take a quick break now and come back with Cassie Rose. Don't go away.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
We are back with the book show, All Sides Weekend Books. I'm Christopher Purdy with Nick White, Chris Hickey, and Cassie Rose, WOSU's book critic. Her blog is thelongestchapter.com. Cassie Rose, what do you have for us to read?
I have a book that was published in 1980 called The Transit of Venus by Shirley Hazzard. I was looking for a book that I could get involved in a way that wasn't like a thriller or a mystery, but just in the whole with the characters and the setting. And I have Shirley Hazzard on my bookshelf, hadn't read many of her books, and I thought, I'm going to read this. Now, first of all, I'm going to say if any of the listeners have read it, there are going to be those who absolutely love it, and I have a feeling there are going to be some who might have dropped out at about page 50, maybe, because it takes a while to build up. In other words, I got to about page 75, and I thought, okay, when is this going to grab me? Have I picked up another book that's not going to? And you have to read part one. You get to the end of part one, and it was like, that was it. And I could not, I was like, all I thought about was, I want to read this book. And it starts out magnificently with this thunderstorm that is going on. And a man named Ted Tice is leaving the train station and looking for a house where he is to spend the next 2 months working with an astronomer. And he finds it. Enters the house. And now here we begin to meet many of the characters. I mean, we have the sisters, Grace and Caroline Bell. And we also have Ted Tice, who is a main player. And also in this, the first part, we have this playwright named Paul Ivory. And all of these characters in the beginning, I mean, you see that Ted Tice begins to, and Caroline and Grace Bell live in this house with the astronomer. Grace is about ready to marry Christian, the astronomer's son. So now you have many of the players, and what you have is this buildup of where Ted Tice is becoming fond of Caroline. And just, and Shirley Hazzard will drop these hints, and she will say, maybe they will become lovers. And you know something will be happening there. But then Paul Lovely comes in, the playwright, and he is engaged to a woman who lives in a nearby castle. Now, this sounds like I'm building up to a pot boiler with all of the elements, but Shirley Hazzard is so, she writes with such depth that that is not at all what is going on. And what happens also in part one is that you get the backstory of Grace and Caroline Bell, of how they were two sisters who were orphaned early in life in Australia, their parents in a boat accident. And they were brought up by their stepsister, Dora, awful Dora. I mean, again, this is beginning to sound like a Dickens novel in a way with some of the characters. But they end up in England. So you get the backstory in part one about that, about the two girls. You also get it about Ted Tice. And what happens in this book, I mean, it truly is about the power of love, because you have adultery that happens. You have unrequited love that happens. You have domestic love and marriage that happens. And the way it grabs you is just the way that she pulls you through, because in the beginning you see that Ted Tice has fallen dramatically for Caroline, but she doesn't return his feelings. And there is a line in, and Shirley Hazzard will, I mean, many times I had to stop and reread some of the lines, because she's telling you a lot of things. And in the first part, she says, in writing about Ted Tice, she says, he will take his own life before he reaches his potential. And so this is the kind of writing that you get with Shirley Hazzard and in the book. I don't want to tell you more about what was going on in part two, like what happens. I mean, I don't know, Nick, this is one of your favorite books.
This is one of my favorite books of all time.
So
I think it is beautifully written. And what I love about the book, once you get to the ending, which I know it said you had like 50 pages to go.
Yes.
Don't give it away.
I won't give anything away, but you will see how everything fits into place. It is like putting together a puzzle. And when you get to that final line, it will
devastate you.
Does all the things that great literature should do, leave you a little hopeful, a little broken, a little grateful that you are able to spend time with these characters. What Shirley Hazzard does in this book that I find masterful, and we should say that the book takes place, I think, right after, or begins right after
World
War II.
It's in the 1950s.
Yeah. Because some think, I remember the mansion that he goes to, or the place that some of the windows are still blacked out because of the Blitz. she's so good at what we call in creative writing classes prolepsis, which is a fancy schmancy term for flash forwards. In the middle of telling a story, she will give you a little bit of the future of that character. And it mm-hmm. can be Ted Tice, the main character, or it can be a side character. You'll find out what happened to them. And you're like, why is she giving me this information? And then 30 pages later, you see how that falls into place. You want to talk about a well-crafted book. This book is written within an inch of its life. It is so beautifully structured. The language, the sentences are amazing, but also the story is just so good. The Bell sisters are so wonderfully rendered on the page.
So now, would you see, here's the thing. So like part two, would you, and I'm not going to say much of what that is about. Like, I don't want to say what is going on about that, like in the relationship that happens in part two, because mm-hmm. I want people to have that, to come to that surprise. And by the way, do not read the introduction before you read the book, because
really,
there's spoilers in it.
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. Luckily, my edition didn't have the introduction, so I went in it cold. But
yeah,
like,
you want to go in it cold, and you all, and that's why I'm saying you have to be patient to get through. You know, the first week. If the language you feel, I mean, whatever. I know that some people might just give it up, and you have to get to the end of part one. I mean, Nick, you said that your students didn't like the book.
My grad students hated the book when mm-hmm. I taught it. To them.
Really consistently?
I only taught it once. I was so heartbroken that they didn't like it that I never taught it again. But I will say that was a lesson learned. Never teach books you truly, truly love.
Yeah, that would be heartbreaking.
Yeah.
But you see what I'm saying about not to give? And mm-hmm. like, so much of the time, like, I will read in the dust jacket flap of a book and I'll see it and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, they're giving away things that they shouldn't.
I know.
So I want people to really be able to experience this book like the way that I was, and you did, like going into it cold, because she is so surprising mm-hmm. about what happens. And it is, you know, heartbreaking. It is, at other times, you're just reading along and it feels normal, or it feels good, or it feels hopeful.
Well, and not a detail is wasted.
Correct.
Like, you
yes.
think some of the stuff, or I thought some of the stuff, especially at the beginning, that she was giving us with this extraneous detail, like, why is she telling me this? Why do I need to know? But then as you begin to go through this world, you realize there's a kind of mythic fatalism to the story mm-hmm. That I found completely enrapturing. This idea of, do we have the power to make, do we have free will, or are we all kind of set on these paths that are already pre-planned mm-hmm. for us in many ways?
Yes, and I think that we can, the book takes place in Sydney, it's also in London, it's in New York, and it's in Stockholm.
Right.
And so it's also very sweeping in that way. And it goes from 1950 to through about the 1980s, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right, yeah.
Shirley Hazard.
Yes, Hazzard.
The Transit of Venus.
The Transit of Venus.
Recommended by two of our panel, Nick White and by Cassie Rose.
It'd be a great book to read on vacation, I think.
Okay, WOSU's mm-hmm. book critic. I've got it written down. Between that and The Great Gatsby, the library's going to be buzzing. Afternoon. Nick White, what do you have for us?
So I am going to take us to a short story collection, a recent short story collection that was published by Grove Press, but the writer was a writer who wrote in the 60s and 70s. Her name is Diane Oliver, and the title of this book is Neighbors and Other mm-hmm. Stories. And she, it's sort of a tragic story about Diane Oliver. She died when she was, I think, 22 years old.
No, really?
Right before she was able to graduate. Yes, she graduated in a motorcycle accident in 1966, so it wasn't 70s, just the 60s. Passed away at 22 in a motorcycle accident right before she was about to graduate with her MFA degree from the Iowa Writers' Workshop. She is a Black writer who writes about the civil rights movement, writes about characters who live in the South and are migrating north. What I find really interesting about her stories is there are glints and shimmers of horror in this work that I found really surprising. I'm thinking in particular of the story in here, which first got me interested in this writer. I had a colleague, Susan Williams, recommend this story to me. Mint Juleps Aren't Served Here. It's about a couple, a husband and wife, Mr. and Mrs. Mack, and their son was, it's alluded to in the story, injured on the playground by a bunch of white kids, and they're so shocked by how this developmentally delays him that they leave Mississippi and they go to some undisclosed place on the map and start living in the forest in this cabin, taking care of their child. And then the story centers around when a social worker finally finds them and what they do about it. And you learn, and I won't give it away here, but you learn what they have been doing to kind of protect their son. And it's both chilling and alarming and completely understandable. I found this work to be, I know, like I said, many of these stories were written in the 60s, but felt very fresh, very immediate, very timely. And I think it also represents a kind of great loss, because I kept thinking when I was reading this book, like, man, what other things would she have written if she had, mm-hmm. if she had lived? And the fact that she was only 22.
So she's writing as a teenager.
Basically. Yeah. And so it's just like such amazing talent. Truly, truly. But this book was just recently issued. There's a great introduction by Terari Jones, who people might know, who wrote An American Marriage, novel that was really popular a few years back. But it's a beautiful, beautiful short story collection. Highly recommend.
Neighbors and Other Stories by Diane Oliver, recommended by Nick White on All Sides Weekend Books. I'm Christopher Purdy with Cassie Rose, with Nick White, and from the library, Chris Hickey, who has quick picks for us. But quick picks are what?
Quick picks are the hot books that we might have a very long hold list. If you come into one of our buildings, we have displays in every building, and if you see that book, you can check it out and skip the line.
Got it.
So I want to talk about The Sirens by Amelia Hart. And Amelia Hart wrote Wayward, which was one of my favorite books in recent years. She does a beautiful job marrying together historic fiction and fantasy. So in this book, it's about a college student. Her name is Lucy, and she is allergic to water. She has a rare allergy to water. So when she gets wet, her skin will flake and become scaly. And so something occurs in college that's very upsetting. So she leaves to find her sister, Jess. And Jess is an artist who lives in a small coastal town. This takes place in Australia. And Jess is missing. Jess also has the same allergy. And she finds a painting that Jess has been working on. Lucy finds a painting. It's very unsettling. And so she starts to snoop around the house. Days have gone by and Jess is nowhere to be found. And this is a coastal town where there has been a history of disappearances. Men disappear near the water. And this has been happening for decades. So she finds this diary and she reads about Jess when she was younger. So they're 20 years. There's 20 years difference between them. And so the diary contains some secrets that are key to this whole story. Now, the third piece to this takes place in the 1800s, and it's a twin sisters from Ireland who are boarding a prison ship for Australia. And so that's where the historic fiction comes in. I did not know about the prison ships in the 1800s, but they would ship women from other countries, and then they would marry them off. They would become, you know, somewhat indentured servants for these men. And so these twin sisters, Eliza and Mary, are terrified of the ocean because they saw their mother walk into the ocean and disappear. Mm. And all assumed that she had drowned. So they're on this voyage from Ireland to Australia. And this voyage will become a celebrated shipwreck. So we know that pretty early in the story. But we're hearing what happened during that shipwreck. All three stories, all three timelines will converge. This is something she is brilliant at. And so she weaves these stories together, and it's just this beautiful story of female resilience. Mm. So if you liked Wayward, you're going to love this one too. It's just beautiful.
That's a quick pick from the Columbus Library.
It's called The Sirens?
The Sirens by Amelia Hart.
Recommendation from Chris Hickey at the library at All Sides Weekend Books. And Cassie Rose, I want to see what's your quick pick right now?
I read a book called Brian by Jeremy Cooper that I absolutely loved. And it's because of the character, Brian, this gentle soul who is a solitude. And he lives in outside London, or maybe Camden is an area within London. But anyway, and he rents an apartment over a Turkish restaurant, and he works at the housing council. And he needs routine, and the sugar bowl is where it needs to be in his cupboard at all times. He needs to keep safe. He needs no surprises. And he wants to, though, he's middle-aged, and he decides he wants to get more involved, though, in community. So he joins a book club, and the women don't like his suggestions and or his hesitating way of talking. And then he decides he'll join, you know, footballers, soccer. And so he goes to the stadium, and he can't stand all the bawdy jokes and the screaming and the drunken men. And he decides to become a member of the BFI, the British Film Institute. And he's always wanted to do that. Well, that point he begins to change. And you know, the thing about him too is that he's not odd, and he is very comfortable with himself, and he just doesn't like to go out and have drinks with people at work. He's not the kind of guy that can do that kind of talking and carrying on. So anyway, he starts going to the films every night, and he recognizes off to the side there is a group of men after the film, and that are regulars, and he sort of sidles up to them and finds that he can be part of them. They don't ask him his name, what he does, or whatever. They all just geek out on the films. And so this becomes this group that he belongs to, and it's all about the films. And they're always afterwards, you know, talking about the producers and the production of the film and the characters and this and this. Well, there's not much that happens in the book. Now, there are some things, like when the laundrette closes, and you know that messes up his routine, or he's involved in a traffic accident. But what really is the underlying plot of this, with this gentle character, is how he becomes, how he belongs. He develops into belonging with this group. How he finds security in filling out his calendar with all the movies that he can look ahead to. And he also begins, during the films, he begins to have feelings that he never knew that he had before. Now, there is in the book a lot about the films. And so there is some film criticism going on.
Are they real films?
Yes, they are. And it's kind of, the BFI struck me as like maybe the Wexner Center type of films. And the thing is, I'm not a film person. But I happily just kept reading through this book and reading through all of what was being written about the films, too, because I loved this character. I loved the time of being with him from his 30s through the point of retirement, and who he was. In the way that the book is written, too, is a big part of that, too, because you can sense an empathy from the Jeremy Cooper, the author, and a great acceptance. That it's not that he's a different person. He is who he is, and he accepts his solitude. And it is how he works with it, or, you know, through his life. And he has friends, like his Mr. Wilson, who is his boss, and he has Lorenzo, who is the owner of the cafe, the Italian that he goes to every day at lunch. But he's just one of those people in the world that once they're opened up to you can't help but to find and see their kindness and want to be with them.
It sounds almost as if Barry himself is not terribly needy, that he is
Brian,
at home. Right,
yes.
Yeah.
Correct. He's not at all needy or complaining or anything like that. And that's a good point, Christopher. Yeah, he's not asking for things or whiny or poor me. That's not it at all.
But he likes his life the way it is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What were some of the movies? I'm just curious.
Oh, gosh. I remember. I do know that there was a Paul Newman and a Robert Redford movie.
The Sting?
Butch Cassidy and the Sundance
Kid. Cassidy, yeah,
I think,
right.
Is Butch Cassidy.
The Sting also has them in there.
Yeah. Yes, and I think that there are just a couple others that I'm just not good at remembering the actors, but I will say, though, that he likens to Japanese films.
Oh, okay.
So that's what I would say that
Kurosawa,
it is. Kurosawa,
yeah, okay, yeah. Yeah. All
so,
right.
I mean, I was fascinated. That part of it was fascinating to me.
If you want to know about the films, read the book. Barry by Jeremy Cooper. We have to take a quick
Brian.
Break.
Yeah.
Brian. Who's
Brian.
Barry? Who the hell's Barry? Brian by Jeremy Cooper. And we're going to take a break. Don't go away. We'll call Barry.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
We are back, All Sides Weekend Books. Before we get to Nick White with a recommendation, Chris Hickey, we've asked you off mic about the library, about requests.
Yes, there is. So on our website, you can click a button that says recommend a title, because we were talking about how Brian is not currently available in the catalog. You can request for purchase titles, and our collection services team will look at that and determine, you know, is it easily accessible? You know, they have a criteria for searching, but often they will
Great.
Buy it. So know that is always an option for you.
Good to know. Thank you, Chris Hickey. And Nick White, what do you have for us?
So I am a really sort of proud teacher right now, because a former student of mine has published a book this year, Margie Sartsfield, and I want to admit my biases firsthand, because I was on the thesis committee for this book. And it's Beta Vulgaris by Margie Sartsfield. And it is such a unique, uncanny, weird, surreal book. It is about, ostensibly, this character named Elise and her boyfriend Tom. And they live in Brooklyn, but they are broke and need to make some extra money. And so they decide to set off for Minnesota to help get a seasonal job working at a sugar beet harvest, where they are getting beets out of the ground.
Where in Brooklyn have they ever heard of?
Well, they're not Brooklyners. They're not okay. Brooklynites. They're not originally from Brooklyn, and so they go there to do that, thinking it's going to be, you know, hard work, but they can make some money that can like last them for a while. But as they begin working, they notice that these beets have a strange pull to them. They hear whispers in the beet piles. And then people start disappearing.
Okay.
And this book is the type of horror novel that sneaks up on you. I remember when I was reading it when it was in the thesis, and just how sort of 30 pages in, I just sort of just widened my eyes and realized, oh my God, what world are we in? This book takes such interesting, brave, bold turns. It really kind of focuses on or flirts with and addresses the uncanny, the void. What does it mean to be alive? What does it mean when things are happening that seem outlandish, but you're sure they're happening and nobody will believe you?
I'm stuck on the beats and people disappearing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So is it connected to the
It's connected to the beats.
So if you eat the beets, you disappear?
No, I don't want to give anything away. It's not if you eat the beets, but there's, let's just say there's large beet piles and there's voices coming from the beet piles.
Oh, the beets might be.
Don't want to give anything away. But again, outlandish premise, but the way it is written, it is completely grounded in place and completely grounded in the situation. I am such a type of reader where it is so easy for me to be thrown out of a story and have a moment of disbelief. Not for a second did I disbelieve anything was happening in this book. She completely sold it to me, and I was riveted. I think the way she writes, I think the...
That's a powerful writer then. She could keep you in there.
And I think what also works for me about this book is that it is operating on another level that a lot of contemporary fiction doesn't work on that much anymore, and that's allegory. And it becomes an allegory for, in many ways, this current moment that a lot of young people are experiencing right now of financial insecurity, food insecurity, the ideas that their lives are not going to be as good or better than their parents. There's actually, you know, they're actually not better off than their parents in many senses, you know, because a lot of the systems in our country are broken. And it gets at that in this idea of emptiness and what's seen and what's unseen. And I was, you know, and of course I'm biased, but I was completely riveted by this book, and it got a really, really great review in the New York Times.
Oh, good.
And so I was really happy about that. Mm-hmm. This is a great writer. I think Margie, this is the first of many great books that Margie has
credit write. To you too.
Well, and Michelle Herman, who directed the thesis. Yeah, yeah.
And by the way, Michelle Herman, now what's the other book you brought?
Oh, yes. I brought Michelle's. Michelle has a new book out too, If You Say So, a collection of essays. My God, Michelle Herman. She is an advice columnist also for Slate. What I love about her essays is it feels as if you're having a conversation with one of the warmest, smartest people in the world. I just love them so much. She has an essay ostensibly about when she started and stopped smoking.
I never knew she smoked, and I've known her for years.
And it's both reasons. She started smoking for a man, and she stopped smoking for a man. And that's the premise. But then it's just like with all great writers, that's just the premise for, like, you know, her thoughts on life, on friendship, on endurance, on making art, on finding community. She writes about dance. She writes about ballet. You know, I am not someone who can dance to save my life. But the way she writes about it is so beautiful, so thoughtful. The way she writes about her body, the way she writes about the city of Columbus and what it means to her. If you are a Columbusite, and listening to this, you should definitely pick up this book and read it. A lot of it will speak to you, I think. It's just a great mind on the page, Michelle Herman.
Full disclosure, she's mentored a bunch of us.
That's so true. That's so true.
She's a neighbor and a dear friend, and I never missed anything. She gave a reading at Clintonville Books recently about this that filled place, and she's going to be doing more as well. You've done a couple with her, and I'm doing a couple with her coming up. If You Say So by Michelle Herman, full disclosure, she's someone we both know and love, and that's, there you are. In fact, she was on the show last month. So, give us a quick pick, Chris Hickey from the library.
Okay, this is called Heartwood by Amity Gage, and it takes place, this is a thriller, it's a mystery, and it has wonderful character development. It takes place in the dense woods of Maine along the Appalachian Trail, and here's how she describes the woods. These are not your normal woods with gentle slopes full of filtered sunlight. These are crowded, witchy, moss dark woods where root to crown the trees battle for light. They have a close, almost bloody smell. And this is our setting. Valerie is a nurse, and she is an experienced hiker, but she has disappeared from the trail. And when we do find her, the reader finds her, she is rationing her food, trying to survive. She's down to one boot, and she is running from someone, and we don't know who it is. Beverly is a game warden, and she is intent on finding her. She finds everyone, and she will find Valerie. That she is determined to do that. Gage explains how you search for someone in such a dense woods, and that was fascinating to me. And Beverly, we also dig into who she is and why she's a game warden and what it was like for her to be the first woman in her area and what it was like to be in a male-dominated profession that is so physical. It's fascinating. There's a third character named Lena, and she lives in a retirement village. She's a bit of a loner, but she's really into foraging and has this online relationship with another person who is fascinated by this missing hiker story. And, oh yeah, it's riveting. We don't know what she's running from, and the woods itself are almost another character. So you've got a feeling of loss. And Gage, in an interview, talked about, you know, being lost. It's not just being physically lost, but emotionally lost and spiritually lost. And all of these characters are lost in their own way. And Valerie, as she's trying to survive, is composing letters to her mother in her journal. And the story was inspired by a real story. A nurse went missing in 2014 in this same area, and they found her remains 2 years later, and her journal was filled with letters to her family. So that was the inspiration.
When you say they found her, was she alive?
No, her remains. They found her remains 2 years later.
All right.
But it's a good mystery, and it's exciting, and it is a page turner.
That's called Heartwood.
Heartwood by Amity Gage.
And that is a quick pick from the Columbus Library. You go in and you might find it on display. It has a long waiting list.
It does.
And again, there are reasons for that, and great cover. Recommended by Chris Hickey from the Columbus Library, the Whetstone Branch, although all branches are wonderful, but we see Chris at the Whetstone Branch. And Cassie Rose, I want to spend some time with you for a recommendation now as the show ends. So what do you have for us?
I'm going to recommend a novella that was written by Saul Bellow. It's called The Bella Rosa Connection, and you can find it in his collected stories and also in another book called Something to Remember Me By, which is another one of his novellas. And the narrator in this story of The Bella Rosa Connection is a man in his 70s. He lives in a mansion in Philadelphia. He has done very well in his life. And this takes place in the 1950s. And he's remembering when he was in his 30s and really hanging out in Greenwich Village. And his father tells him he wants him to meet his stepmother's nephew. And so he meets Harry Fonstein and his wife, Sorella, who are this is in New Jersey. And the story about Harry Fonstein is, and why he wanted him to meet him, is because Harry Fonstein and his mother escaped from Nazi Germany to Italy. And when they were in Italy, Harry was put into a cell. He was captured. And then a man appeared at his cell door and told him at a certain time the cell door would be opened, and that he should leave it and turn left and left and left and left, keep turning left until he found a car. And he ends up on a boat from Lisbon to America, and he finds out that a man named Billy Rose had facilitated this escape. Billy Rose was a major Hollywood celebrity who is Saul Bellow, took from real life. And what he had going was an underground helping the Jewish refugees. So Harry wanted to meet him and say thank you, but a woman shows up and basically says that's not going to happen at Ellis Island. And I'll just shorten it and say he ends up in Cuba. He finds his wife, Sorella. Now, Sorella is a great character. She's obese, and she has a bouffant hairstyle, a beehive hairstyle. This is the 50s, and wears a pince-nez. And she turns out to be the most incredible person in this book or this novella, because she is strategic, she is strong, she is quick thinking, and she helps Harry become actually who he is. And she also helps him find a way to say thank you to Billy Rose. The book is about the narrator too, and I will leave it at that, because the power of the story comes at the end when it's about being an American Jew who was here in the United States in the 1940s, while your European Jews, the people that are your people were going under such brutality. How do you reconcile that?
And that is today's show. We began with The Great Gatsby and ended with Saul Bellow. What a great show this was. Thank you so much, Nick White. Thank you, Chris Hickey. Thank you, Cassie Rose. Thank you, Chris Johnson, for making radio all of us. Thank you, Marcus Charleston, our producer. I'm Christopher Purdy. This has been All Sides Weekend Books on 89.7 NPR News. Don't just sit there. Go read.